And so it's like if you have two friends that you know would hit it off, but they've never had a chance to meet each other. So you have a party to introduce themselves to each other. That's what this book is. This is my party to introduce social science and data science to each other.
I'm J.B. Wogan from Mathematica, and welcome back to On the Evidence, a show that examines what we know about today's most urgent challenges and how we can make progress in addressing them. On this episode, we're talking with Matt Salganik about the merging worlds of computer science and social science to produce timely, policy-relevant research in the 21st century. Last month was the five-year anniversary of Matt's book, Bit by Bit, in which he shows how traditional research techniques in the social sciences can sometimes be combined with big data and other digital tools to generate high-quality evidence on a larger scale, in less time, and at a much lower cost. Matt is a professor of sociology at Princeton University and a member of Mathematica's board of directors. He is also a co-founder of the Summer Institutes for Computational Social Science, a global program that offers free trainings to data scientists and social scientists who wish to draw from both disciplines to generate fresh insights about public policy. In 2020, Mathematica and Howard University partnered to host the first Summer Institute for Computational Social Science at a historically black college or university. It was also the first to orient its coursework around anti-black racism and inequities. Longtime listeners of the show we'll remember a previous episode in 2021 that focused on the Summer Institute at Howard University, and I'll include a link to that episode in our show notes. To kick off this episode, I've asked Mathematica's president and CEO, Paul Decker, to help me contextualize the importance of Matt's book to organizations like Mathematica that collect and analyze data, and to the people that we partner with in government, philanthropy, and the private sector, who use those data to make better decisions and ultimately improve public well-being. Paul became CEO of Mathematica in 2007, the first year that Matt taught a course on web-based social science research, a course that would eventually become the Bit by Bit book. And as Paul remembers, it was around that time that evidence-generating organizations like Mathematica started to recognize the importance of data science and new analytical methods related to data science.
And so one of the challenges I was faced with in leading Mathematica was how to think about data science in a social science research context. And my sense was that data science was adding something unique and productive to the picture, that data science ability or focus on leveraging technology, leveraging advances of technology as well as the democratization of data sources, being able to rely on big data, being able to rely on administrative records much more productively than in the past in the policy research field really opened up opportunities in the field for data science.
So around the time that Matt was teaching his course on social science and big data, Paul was developing a vision for how Mathematica, an organization steeped in traditional social science research, could begin to incorporate data science into its work. Paul knew that the integration of social science and data science would eventually happen across the industry. It was the future of policy research.
But there wasn't anybody really articulating what the integration might look like.
Then Paul heard about Matt's book and had a chance to talk with Matt about his ideas.
It was a discovery of somebody who thought more carefully about this integration. And I really liked the way in which Matt framed it as a combination of two different perspectives that bring different strengths to the table, because that's really what I had in my head when I thought about how we build capabilities at Mathematica over time to be able to provide the best possible support for our clients that would build on the strengths of both traditions.
When Matt's book published, it anticipated that the integration of data science into the social sciences would change policy research. So I asked Paul, how has it changed Mathematica's work?
Those methods and capabilities are helping us leverage data in ways that we just weren't able to do in the past. So it allows us to access a broader set of data sources, different structures of data, including unstructured data, whether those data come in the form of video files, audio files, text files. All of those can be analyzed in ways that we couldn't analyze them in the past. So that just allows us a much richer approach to our work so we can deliver better on our mission of helping drive better decision making based on evidence that we uncover.
Something that Paul has mentioned to me in the past and that I wanted to ask him about in the context of Matt's book is that the data revolution, which involves big data and data science, represented an important and sustainable shift in the field of policy research in the ways that other methodological innovations have not. I was curious why, in Paul's opinion, the trends Matt explores in his book had more staying power.
When we're talking about the value added by accessing big data, I think the value is inherent in the name. Big data means we're introducing new data or new information to the estimation process. As opposed to in the past, where often we would see methodological fads that were based on different ways of manipulating data statistically without adding any new data to the picture. So in a lot of those cases, I think, given that context, it wasn't surprising that the new methodology didn't consistently generate different or better results, in a lot of cases, from estimation. But when you're introducing new information, as in the case of big data, that new information means you can generate improved estimates.
Okay. Hopefully that contextual framing from Paul is helpful in thinking about why the rise of computational social science is such an important development for organizations that conduct policy research and the people who rely on evidence from policy research to make decisions. We're now going to switch to my interview with Matt about the 5-year anniversary of his book, Bit by Bit. This interview was recorded in December of 2022. A full transcript of the episode is available on the blog post associated with this episode at mathematica.org. I'll also add links to related resources, including a free online version of Matt's book, in the episode show notes. I think where it would make sense to start is to give listeners just a sense of what Bit by Bit is about and what your goals were around writing the book in the first place.
Sure. Bit by Bit is for social scientists that want to do more data scientists that want to do more social science, and anyone interested in the hybrid of these two fields. And I spend time in each of these fields, and I can see that people in them have a lot to learn from the other fields and also a lot to contribute. And so it's like if you have two friends that you know would hit it off, but they've never had a chance to meet each other, so you have a party to introduce themselves to each other. That's what this book is. This is my party to introduce social science and data science to each other.
In the book, you talk about part of the genesis being a course that you were teaching too, right? This was supposed to be, it's documenting stuff, work you were kind of already doing in the course, and also a way of supporting that course going forward. So is that's another aspect of why you wrote it?
Yes, absolutely. So this book grew out of a course that I was teaching at Princeton starting in 2007, which was my first year there. I believe that was before the term computational social science became popular. At the time, I was calling the course something else called web-based social research. And what was happening is that I was assigning papers to, this was a course for graduate students. I would assign them individual papers. And then during the class, we would talk about some of the broader issues and trying to think about how those papers fit together, how they tie into core ideas from social science, how they tie into core ideas from data science. And I found that there was a lot of stuff that's really just missing if you read paper by paper, this kind of connective tissue, big picture. And so part of the goal of the book is to write all that down so that people can have that perspective as they approach the field.
Okay. And we're talking at the 5-year anniversary of the book, which is even farther back than the original. So 2007. Yes. Yeah, so we're at, was it 13, 15? So that'd be 15 years since you started the course. I was wondering, has the course changed? Like, would somebody who took that course in 2007 notice big differences today? Did the book actually help change anything, update anything, or were there certain major changes that you would flag?
I think the book aged well and the course aged well, largely because of the design of them. So I was trying very hard when I wrote this book to have it make sense in 5 years, because there's a lot of books in computational social science that I think do not age well. And the books that don't age well tend to be much more specific. And so I think the key to staying relevant is to abstract away some of the details. And so I don't spend a ton of time in the book talking about specific platforms, because those are constantly changing. New platforms are constantly being created. New technologies are being created. But I think if you move one level of abstraction up, there are a lot of commonalities, things that make sense today, things that make sense 5 years ago, things that make sense 5 years from now. So I think that part of the book has really aged well. That's not to say there are not changes. So sometimes, in fact, the things that are old are new again. So my first year I taught the course, I had a whole week devoted to virtual worlds, things like Second Life. And there was a lot of thinking at the time that Second Life would be a future place for social science research to occur. That did not turn out to be the case. However, now we are very excited about the metaverse, which has some of the same characteristics as Second Life. And more generally, I think the value of seeing this over this longer historical arc is to see that there are things that come and go, and there are things that remain. And focusing on the things that remain is likely to be the most helpful for the future.
That is so funny. I wonder how many of our listeners will know or remember what Second Life is. I remember it because it was either the first or one of the first topics that I was actually paid to write about as a journalist. I was freelancing for a newspaper that, like a lot of places, doesn't exist anymore, but it was the Jewish Transcript News in Seattle. And they wanted someone to write a feature story about the thriving Jewish community on Second Life and people's different experiences with sort of exploring their Jewish identity in this alternate universe. But yeah, I could see how in some ways Facebook, and now I guess you're saying the metaverse, but even just social media was a version of a Second Life. It wasn't the Second Life.
That's true. One other thing about the history of the course, all the syllabi from the course are posted on my website, so you could include those in the show notes if people want to review the syllabus from 2007 and review it from the last time I taught the course.
Okay. Okay, that's great. Yeah, I can add that to the show notes. So 5 years later, I'm curious what the impact of the book has been, and also how you think about the impact. Like, how would you define or measure the impact of the book since it came out?
It's interesting. I think I'll talk, I guess, a little bit more about my personal experience first, and then we can talk a little bit more about how to think about measuring the impact. Personally, it's been incredibly rewarding when people come up to me and say, oh, I read your book and it really helped me. Also, when you hear that from people all over the world, I was just in Holland giving a talk and someone there said they were new to the field of computational social science. One of their colleagues gave them this book and they loved it. It really helped them get started in the field. And to me, that was just so cool because it's people that I never even imagined when I was writing it. How would you measure impact of a book? I think in some ways it got a very positive review in Science when it came out. So like, to me, that's awesome. It got a number of very positive reviews from people that I respect a lot. It's been translated into 5 languages now: Chinese, Japanese, Korean, Italian, and Turkish. And if any of your listeners know of other languages that they would like the book to be translated in, please contact me so we can try to help make that happen. It's been used in courses around the world. It's been cited in lots of research. all different kinds of courses, graduate courses and undergraduate courses, computer science and social science. I have a list of courses that have used the book on the book's website. So there I've open sourced my own teaching materials related to the book and encourage other people who use the book in their class to upload their own teaching materials so that anyone who's thinking of using it in a course has access to see what other people have done as they're designing their own course. And so you can see there, very widespread adoption, social science, data science, undergrads, grad students, intern, US, outside of the US, it's amazing.
Do you know if it's being used as a training resource for private organizations? I know, you know, it's obviously something people are aware of at Mathematica, but like you mentioned in the book, your own experience with some private companies like Facebook or Google, like are there private companies like that this is part of the required reading or at least something recommended reading for people they're onboarding?
Sure. I know the Facebook data science team read it for their book club a few years ago. I know I've given talks at a number of companies. And so I'm really happy for anyone to read it and learn from it. I do think also the lessons from the book are very relevant to anyone, whether they work in a company, a government, or university, an NGO.
One of the things that you talk about right from the outset, I think comes up throughout the book is, well, and you just mentioned it in our podcast here too, about sort of creating a dinner party environment where people from these two different communities can socialize and learn more about each other. And so I was wondering, do you think that those two communities, those two different sides understand each other better now? And to the extent that there are still gaps, you know, what are you thinking about in terms of ways to bridge those gaps?
Sure. I definitely think the two communities understand each other better now than they did before. This was a natural evolution that was going to happen. So at the beginning of a lot of research, new kinds of research, there's just a lot of uncertainty. People don't know. Over time, there have been a lot of things that have helped the community form and develop some shared language. So I'm thinking of, for example, there's now a conference, IC2S2, International Conference of Computational Social Science. There's also the Summer Institutes in Computational Social Science, which is a training program. And there are many other universities that now offer these courses. So at the time that Bit by Bit was published, these courses were relatively rare. And now they're becoming increasingly common, which I think is a great thing. I also forgot one thing about impact. Bit by Bit recently received the APOR Book Award, which I was very happy about and honored to receive because it's a community that I drew from a lot in my work, and to be recognized by that community was very special. And one thing that's especially nice about that award is that the book has to be published for at least 3 years. And so it's like an award where they want to wait and see how the book has aged before they give it. And so it's very nice that they had thought that it had aged well.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you were very intentional about that. Like you were talking about abstraction earlier, and like you gave the example of rather than teaching people how to use Twitter API, you're giving some guidance around using big data, knowing that, you know, the specifics of Twitter, it may not be Twitter API in the future, maybe some other manifestation of big data.
As we're talking, Twitter is undergoing some incredibly major changes very quickly. So you never know what's going to happen. No matter what Twitter becomes, and no matter, you know, if Twitter goes out of business and becomes replaced by something else, I think the principles of the book will still likely apply to the new Twitter or whatever Twitter becomes.
When you were talking about impact, I wondered if you would bring up the Summer Institutes for Computational Social Science. Is that another way to think about, like, do you see a direct causal relationship that the book comes out and then these institutes start to proliferate, or is there, or could clarify for me what the relationship is between the six, including the one that Mathematica sponsors with Howard, and the book?
Sure. They're definitely related. So the Summer Institutes in Computational Social Science is something that I started with a colleague named Chris Bale. with funding from the Russell Sage Foundation. And we started our first one in 2017 at Princeton, so right around the time that Bit by Bit was finished. And the goal of the program was similar to the goal of Bit by Bit, which is help people learn about computational social science, help build a community in this area. And so we had 30 people, graduate students, postdocs, and junior faculty from the social sciences and data scientists come to Princeton. And it was amazing. Like, they learned so much. We ended up with something like 300 applications. So we realized we weren't able to provide this opportunity to everyone that we wanted. So we decided to live stream the Summer Institute, the first one. Then during the Summer Institute, we quickly realized that more than the live stream, there's the community aspect, the being together with these other people, that was really valuable. And so we started the next year in 2018 having partner locations that were run by alums from the Summer Institute at another university or organization. And so in 2018, I think we had something like 7. In 2019, I think we had something like 11. And then it keeps growing. Through COVID, we continued. I think this past year, we had about 30 all over the world, including one that was run by Howard University in Washington, D.C. and Mathematica. And that was a very special partner location.
In terms of impact, there's one other thing I meant to ask, which is about reader responses. You mentioned there were a couple of people who've come up to you to say, thank you, I read the book, it's useful to me. But are there any specific stories? Like, I'm curious, like you mentioned that you had worked at the census. Like, have people from the U.S. Census Bureau read your book, and are they applying ideas from it? Or, you know, are there any interesting stories you've heard about how people have been influenced or are applying ideas from the book?
I believe some people from the census have certainly heard about it, because I gave a talk at the Census Bureau about the book a few years ago. In terms of like specific things, I think maybe I don't have any particular stories. I think the citation count is maybe one way of looking at academic impact. And I don't have that. I'm looking up that right now. But yeah, it's been cited 720 times, which is great. And, you know, I hope each of those has a story behind it.
So while I have a hard copy and people can buy a hard copy, it's a free version is available online for anyone to look at, right? That you, if
that's people... correct. Anyone to look at and contribute to. And so what we did, the book is about social research in the digital age, and I wanted to publish the book in a way that's fitting of the digital age. And so what happened is we created a process called the open review. So you're very familiar with the concept of peer review, which is while I submitted my manuscript to the press, they sent it to experts to be reviewed to make sure that it was appropriate and to collect feedback on it. And then I took those comments from those experts and improved the manuscript. While it was going through peer review, it went through a parallel open review process where I posted the entire text of the book online, and anyone could read it and annotate any particular part that they wanted. And this was incredibly helpful for getting good feedback. The feedback from the two processes were quite different. The feedback from the peer review was often about bigger picture issues about the book from experts. Like, I think it could have had a chapter about text analysis, things like that. The open review comments were much more specific, and they were not always from experts. So they would say, this sentence is confusing to me. And that's actually incredibly helpful feedback. It's different feedback, but it's very, very helpful. And so through combining the feedback that you get from the open review with the feedback you get from the peer review, you can produce a better book. The open review also allows for comments that are incredibly specific by what you could call like micro experts. So for example, the book is full of examples about that illustrate different points about computational social science. And sometimes the authors of those papers would write in and annotate about how I had described their paper. So incredible expertise that you can't really get in peer review either, because there's hundreds of examples in the book. And so you can't send it to every one of those people. So the open review process leads to these better books. It also leads to increased access to knowledge. So the book is available now for anyone who wants to read it. And it also leads to higher sales. This was designed to be done in a way that's friendly to academic publishing because that needs to be a sustainable business. And so, for example, we were able to collect email addresses of people who were interested in receiving an email when the book was available for purchase. Then we emailed all those people on the launch day and we had a big launch and it became the number one bestseller on Amazon in the category of social science research methodology. But so again, the goal of this, and then I got a grant from the Sloan Foundation to open source all the software that we did for the open review toolkit so that other people can do this with their own book. And again, the goals are better books, higher sales, increased access to knowledge, and the software is all open source and other people can use it as they wish. I think open access to books is a next frontier in the open access movement. There's a lot of fighting and action related to open access to academic journals. There's still a lot of work to be done, but there is progress there. And I think open knowledge around books is a next frontier that we should start working towards.
And the higher sales element is interesting. I think it's a little counterintuitive. It's not, like, before you explained the mechanisms and how you actually were able to use it, I think people would have assumed that there would have been a trade-off there in terms of greater access of information, but lower revenue as a result.
No, I think that's an illusion. Plenty of companies make a lot of money by being free online. The challenge is to get something in return when you make something free. And so we do get stuff in return. The biggest thing is we get eyeballs of people who are interested in buying the book. One of the biggest challenges with selling books is to make sure that people who are interested in it know about it. This is a very good mechanism for that. You'll also see, you mentioned you looked at it online. You saw there was an ad for the book that shows up. After you read it online, you'll see an ad for the book, right? This is a way to sell books to people who are interested. People think there's a tension between access and sales, and I don't think there needs to be that. If it's designed well, it can be something that moves us forward in both directions. That's one of the things that's exciting about the digital age, is that things that people assume are trade-offs, the nature of those trade-offs can be quite different. I mean, this is part of the theme of the book. Like, a lot of the things that we have done in the past as social scientists were in part because of the constraints that existed. As those constraints change, we can do different things. Sometimes that allows us to move into a different part of the design space that was just basically not possible before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for me, I think I read the preface, maybe the introduction online, and then I got a sense of the style of writing and also sort of the length of the book and recognized that I'd be able to read it as a former English major and journalist with no computer science background. I would be able to read it. And secondly, that it would be hard for me to stay focused on reading a book online of this length, that it would make more sense for me to get a hard copy, an analog version, for me to do a deeper dive and close the laptop. I don't know if I'm unusual among readers in that sense, but it's interesting.
Yep, I think that's a very common path. And I hope people, when they read it, they enjoy it and get excited about it. And then that moves them to want to, you know, engage with it in a physical way. I also am glad to hear that you found the book accessible. This is one of the really important things about the book. I wanted it to be accessible to both social scientists and data scientists. And so that forces you to write in a way that I tried to think, anyone who can read the New York Times, that's the audience I'm looking for this book. And so in some ways, having a dual audience makes the writing difficult, but in other ways, that forces you to be accessible in your writing. And so I'm glad to hear that you thought that came through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it definitely did. I wanted to ask about, you introduced the idea of ready-made and custom-made policy research techniques. I'm going to butcher the pronunciation, but there's the Duchamp, Duchamp and Michelangelo, right? Michelangelo's David, and then is it a toilet that Duchamp
has? Fountain is what he named it. But yes, it is a urinal.
Okay, thank you. And so one of those, the David is custom made and the fountain is ready made. Could you explain a little bit more about how those are sort of metaphors for policy research? And then I was curious if are there any new evocative examples of combining those techniques that have come out since the book first published?
Sure. So one way I like to explain is I think data science sometimes is like a urinal, but not just any urinal. It's a very special urinal. So Fountain by Duchamp is a beautiful piece of art that changed what people think art could be. And how Duchamp did that is through very creative repurposing. He saw this urinal that was created for one purpose, and he said, no, I'm going to use it for a different purpose. This urinal is art. And that is a very creative thing, and it can change people's perspective about what's possible. Research using data science often has a very similar flavor because data is usually sometimes is created for one purpose. That purpose is usually not research. It could be helping a company run. It could be administering laws. This kind of data is created for one purpose, and then researchers can see it and repurpose it and use it for something else. And so I think a lot of the best data science work has this characteristic of very creative uses of data that were created for other purposes. So Google Flu Trends is an example that many of your listeners may be familiar with. Google Flu Trends, it had this great idea that people are typing things into the Google search engine, and they perhaps could use that to measure the prevalence of influenza, the flu. And so this was a very creative repurposing of the search data and very exciting. Then the problem with repurposed data, however, is that it wasn't created for the purposes of research. And so it doesn't have some of the good properties that we like. And Google Flu Trends, for example, broke down in its accuracy over time as Google started to change the way its search engine worked. Because Google was making those changes not because they were trying to maximize the accuracy of Flu Trends, but because they were trying to run a search engine company, right? And so like a lot of these platforms, they're constantly changing. So this is one of the properties of big data sources that I talk about in chapter 2, drift and algorithmic confounding, ways that the creation of the algorithms changes the kinds of data that people create, which can change the kinds of inferences that you can draw. So this is an example of both the beauty and excitement of ready-made data sources, as well as the risks and concerns. And so I contrast that to the work that social scientists are more familiar with, where we create the data for the purposes of our research. And so that means it has very different properties. And that I associate more with artists like Michelangelo making David. He didn't look for something that kind of looked like David. He spent 3 years making David. And that's a model that social scientists are more accustomed to. And I think increasingly, either of these pure approaches is limited. So if you are used to working with ready-made data, you'll start to realize that there are really serious problems often with this kind of data, serious limitations. So data that was not created to answer your question. And so you're going to have to start investing more in custom-made data. Likewise, if you're used to using custom-made data, it becomes increasingly impossible to ignore all the ready-made data in the world. Like you might say, let's say you're a health researcher. You might say, I only believe in randomized controlled trials or something like that. And when there's no electronic medical records, maybe that is a somewhat plausible position. As the amount of electronic medical records and other kinds of digital traces of health behavior increases, if your goal is to learn about health, it becomes increasingly hard to ignore all that other data. That doesn't mean you should embrace it without understanding it. It doesn't mean you should not. It means like you have to take advantage of both of these things. And we're seeing much more integration of ready-made and custom-made data since the book has been written. And it's a trend that I think will likely continue.
Were there any cool, new, sexy examples that you've seen? Google Trends is a good example.
Yeah, but it's good because it is both cool and sexy, and it failed in the end.
Yeah,
and they shut it down. It's hard. It's really hard to do well.
Yeah, yeah. I imagine there have to be analogous, different things like that during the pandemic, where people were trying to use, ready-made data sets to get new insights about COVID-19.
Absolutely. I'm sure there were. I think the one that I believe I'd heard about is using data from some companies about people's mobility to try to track how that was affected by lockdowns and other kinds of restrictions. Mm. I don't know that much about that work, though.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I was wondering, so 5 years have passed, people are often issuing new editions of their books. If you were to be, issuing a new edition, if you were writing an update, are there chapters you would add? Are there topics that you wish you had covered or that you would love to cover in a new edition?
There's a lot of stuff that I did not include, but I feel like those decisions have aged well, because subsequently people have written books entirely dedicated to this topic. So for example, a big topic that is not in my book is about working with text as data. This comes up a lot in computational social science. People are very excited about working with this new form of data. It raises special statistical issues. I decided to leave it out because it's a subject of a whole nother book. And now one of my colleagues, Brandon Stewart, has written a fantastic book on this topic called Text as Data, which he wrote with Justin Grimmer and Molly Roberts. So I think we're seeing more. Another thing that's completely absent from the book is anything about programming. This is another thing where we see lots of other books written about these topics. So I think of this book existing in a kind of constellation of other books and not trying to do everything all on its own. I think a couple things that I see, one kind of very narrow thing that I see is missing is I talk some, actually in chapter 2, chapter 3, chapter 5, and several of the chapters about using machine learning inside of research process, where you kind of do machine learning as an intermediate step to, for example, label text or label images. And I think it has now become clear that some of the statistical and technical issues with that are a little more complicated than was clear at the beginning. So I would say that's not really a new topic, but I would like to add in some of what's been learned subsequently about how to do that carefully. The other big thing that I think is missing is, so that's a little thing. And the big thing is more about how technology is impacting society. So within computational social science, there's kind of some work is about using new data or new techniques to answer old questions. But some of it is about answering new questions about the world. So for example, social media changes the way politics happens. Social media may have impact mental health of teens. What are those kind of impacts? How do we measure them? How do we study them? How do we make decisions about what we want technology to be? So how should technologies be regulated? What kinds of transparency requirements should exist? This is a whole different topic, a very interesting topic, but many of the techniques that are described in the book are also very relevant for these other questions about understanding and improving the relationship between technology and society. So rather than thinking about a new edition of this, I'm actually writing a new book about a different topic. It's about predicting the future. So this year I'm on sabbatical at the Institute for Advanced Study, and subsequent to writing Bit by Bit, some of my work has been about using machine learning and AI techniques to predict life outcomes for individual people. So given some information about someone, how well can we predict what will happen to them in the future? This is a core scientific question. It's also very important for policymakers who are considering using predictive models to help improve the allocation of services to their people they're trying to help. And my research so far has found that this has been not nearly as effective as I expected. And so now I'm trying to understand in general different ways that we can predict the future and what are the limits to what it is that we can possibly do and what it is that we should be doing.
That's interesting. So the area where I was wondering if there might be an update was around equity, like the some of the subject matter that has become the theme of the Howard Mathematica 6. And it's not to say that it's not in there in a way, because I think a lot of the discussion in the ethics chapter could apply, but it's not using the same kind of language of today around algorithmic bias. I don't know if the phrase algorithmic bias appears, and maybe it does, but yeah, I was curious if there would be a new edition that would have a section or a chapter on the dangers of AI and machine learning exacerbating inequities or sort of.
Is what I meant when I talked about the intersection between technology and society. So this is largely a book about research using computational social science. And I think there's a whole new set of considerations that gets introduced once you start deploying this technology in society. So it's one thing to study predictability, you know, in an abstract academic setting. And then it's another thing to try to use predictions in a real delivery of social services. And there is a lot that needs to be understood better about how we deploy these technologies in the world. It's not nearly as simple as, oh, here's a textbook about random forests. So I can run a random forest model and now I'll just deploy this into a real government organization. That to me seems like a recipe for disaster. This stuff needs to be done very carefully. There needs to be a lot of thinking about all the things around the predictive model, because often that is where some of the most important problems can arise. In the predictive model itself, also needs to be understood some of these concerns about equity, justice, differential impact, and so on. All of these things are outside of what you would get in a traditional machine learning textbook. Now, there's a lot of advancement in this area now that's very exciting. One of my colleagues, Arvind Narayanan, has a new book coming out about fairness in machine learning, which I think will be excellent. It's co-authored with Moritz Hart and Solon Barakas.
Okay. And do you have a working title for your book and a sense of when it might come out? Or is it too nascent at this point? Okay.
Too nascent at this point. But that is definitely what I'm most excited about going forward, is using some of the ideas in Bit by Bit to think about predicting the future and to think about the challenges that arise when you do computational social science in the world. It's one thing to do it in an academic setting. It's another thing to do it in the world. And there's a whole new set of issues that need to be considered really carefully. I'm glad you mentioned the ethics chapter. So the book has a lot about ethics. Ethics runs through all of the chapters. Has a very long chapter about ethics that was probably the hardest chapter for me to write. As just personally, it was very hard to write because I don't know, I'm not trained as an ethicist, and it's the first time I've ever had to write about something like that. But that chapter is the one where I think I've gotten the most positive feedback, where people have told me that that was very, very helpful to them. And because a lot of the work that's written about ethics now is not written by empirical researchers. It's written by people who specialize in ethics, and that has a place. But I think there's also a place for people that do empirical research that want to think about ethics. I hope this chapter can be helpful to them as well, and is a little bit from a different perspective of someone who's used to doing this work, not just writing about this work.
Mm-hmm. Maybe it would be worth, I really enjoyed that chapter. I don't know if you did this, but it stood out to me as a chapter that could have been an essay on its own or an op-ed somewhere, because you're putting forward a thesis and you're calling for a principle-based approach as opposed to other approaches. I think it was ad hoc and it's
rules-based.
What is it called? Rules-based. Okay, I was going to say IRB.
So the data scientists generally use an ad hoc approach where they often think about it, sometimes quite carefully, but in the absence of any kind of framework. And then many social scientists follow a rules-based approach of, I just do what the IRB allows me to do. And I think both of those approaches are incomplete. And so in the chapter about ethics, I put forward a principles-based approach. When I was writing this, I thought, oh, I'll have to figure out what are the principles that researchers should follow. And I started reading around and I'm like, wow, there's no way I can figure out what are the principles. And in fact, I don't have to because people have already done that, right? And so I draw extensively on two other documents. The first is the Belmont Report, which was written in the early 1970s, published in the early 1970s about research ethics in the social and medical sciences. And then the other document is something called the Menlo Report, which was published much later and is much more about ethics in computer science research, which brings up a number of different kinds of issues. And so from those two reports, the Belmont Report and the Menlo Report, I'm able to put forward four principles that I think should guide researchers and then show how those four principles themselves can be derived from two larger ethical frameworks. And so none of that is new philosophically, but I think seeing it organized like that, I've heard many people say it's helpful to them. I know it's been helpful to me as I think through new research problems, using those principles and frameworks to kind of guide my thinking has proven to be very helpful.
Am I remembering correctly, the Belmont Report is something that your former board member, colleague, Pat King had co-authored, or is that, did
yes.
she work on something? Did you yes, all talk Pat about King. That? Was she?
We
was
did she... a little bit. I didn't know that Pat King had worked on the Belmont Report until somehow I found out once we were on the board and I asked her about it. And she had some wonderful stories about like rich and deep and serious discussions that they had. It's an amazing document. The actual Belmont Report is incredibly short. It's something like 20 pages. But then there's two appendices that are like, that, I don't know, 1,000 pages each or something, a very detailed commentary and debate and discussion. And so it just, it is a really, I think those 20 pages are a very, very powerful document that has a lot of staying power.
It's so funny that she wrote something, contributed to the writing of something that influenced your book and you ended up working together, but it wasn't, the timing didn't work out. It wasn't as if you were able to consult her as a colleague while you were yes. generating the book.
Yes.
So I was curious, I honestly don't know, how have you, or have you incorporated ideas in Bit by Bit in your role as a Mathematica board member? Like, are there ways in which you're able to probe the company's leadership around their use of data science or advocate for the use of data science? I don't know exactly, you know, but I'm sure that they would benefit, or they do benefit from your expertise and perspective in this area, but I wasn't sure exactly how it manifests.
Sure. So in our role as members of the board, our job is to provide kind of high level oversight and guidance to the company. And so it's not the case, like we never like do code review or talk about specific details of specific projects as much as I would personally like to do that. So the way it enters my role in the board, I think, comes from me thinking a lot about what's the difference between the form of something and the soul of something. And I want to explain what I mean by that. So like, let's take survey research. Survey research looks a certain way. It looked a certain way in 1950. When we think about survey research today, we should think, what about survey research is just constrained by the technologies of the day? And what about survey research is fundamental to the core of its essence? So what's the form versus what's the soul? The soul is what's really important, what we need to keep. The form is what needs to change, in fact, not just should change, but needs to change. And so in general, trying to probe and ask people, like, what about this is the core soul that needs to stay the same? What are you trying to do and preserve in a fundamental way? And what can you change in order to make it better, faster, cheaper? Like, because if you change and you destroy the soul, that's a bad change. right? But if you change the form and preserve the soul, that actually can create a lot of new opportunities. So trying to think really hard about why are things the way they are now? How much of those are real constraints about the soul? And how much of those are artificial constraints that have grown historically based on the limits of our technology?
I'm thinking about, in the book, you give the example of photography and cinematography of a single photograph or 20 photographs or, you know, what we have today with HD, you know, just like very seamless, high resolution film today. I was trying to think about like what that would mean for Mathematica in 10 or 20 years in terms of the techniques we use to answer certain questions and how, you know, it may be the goals might be the same in terms of the questions we're trying to answer, but the ways in which we're answering those questions could be completely different.
Absolutely. So I think you'll see increasing moves to ready-made data. We'll need to figure out what are the appropriate safeguards and controls to make sure that is done in a responsible way. You'll see, I think, a lot more automated or quasi-automated decision-making. I think there's a lot of things that are also hard for us to imagine right now. I mean, that's the other thing is, in the book, I talk a lot about comparing not just what something is today, but what it will become. So I try to think a lot about, like, oftentimes, if you see the first version of something, it's not very good. It's expensive, it's complicated, it's clunky. But the really important thing is to look not just at what it is now, but where it will be in the future. And so I try to think a lot about, okay, forget about this today. What's this going to look like 5 years from now? What's this going to look like 10 years from now? And how do we need to be behaving today to take advantage of those opportunities?
I want to shift gears. The last question I wanted to ask was about policymakers. Maybe I would throw in like decision makers more broadly in policy and programs, but not necessarily the two camps we've talked about already, not the data scientists, not the social scientists, but people who might be users of the kind of major takeaways from social science research or computational science research, computational social science research, I should say. So like I could imagine, like I wondered if there's a Cliff Notes version for decision makers, but what should those readers and those listeners know about the evolving field of computational social science? And what do you think their role should be? What role do they have to play in terms of midwifing this field and ensuring that it's practiced in a principle-based, you know, ethical manner?
Sure. I think they have an important role and a huge responsibility. Now, I think, so in one way, the book is for people who are doing social science or computational social science. In another way, I think the book will be very helpful for anyone who is consuming computational social science produced by other people. So if you have data scientists reporting to you, if you have social scientists reporting to you, how do you know how to evaluate their work? How do you know what questions you should be asking them? How do you make sure they're behaving in a ethical way that's consistent with the values of your organization? So all of the things in the book are helpful for those things as well. There's nothing in the book that's about how to actually do something, about how to actually program something up. It's all really a series of ideas that you can carry around in your head and pull out and when you see something. So you see something, it reminds you of something from the book, you can pull it out, ask a question about that, make a suggestion based on that. And so I'd like to think that it would be very, very helpful to anyone who is consuming this kind of research to help them ask the right questions, be realistic about what's possible and what is not possible. So I hope it would be helpful to everyone.
My spidey sense was going off a little bit when I was reading about how the laws and regulations are always a little bit behind the change of technology. And I wondered if there might be someone on a legislative staffer in Congress who might be saying to themselves like, okay, well, that's always going to be reality, but like, what can we do to try to be a little bit more in sync with how social science in the digital age is evolving and try to anticipate some of the problems that Matt is bringing up in the book. I mean, do you think that that's another potential audience that should be hit here?
Absolutely. So I've just spent the three previous years, I was the director of a center at Princeton that tries to do just this. It's called the Center for Information Technology Policy. It's joint between Princeton School of Engineering and Public Policy. And we work to understand and improve the relationship between technology and society. And we take both of those verbs very seriously. So understand, we do at the center, we do research that helps advance the state of the art in topics like machine learning, privacy and security, digital platforms, and so on. And then improve, we engage directly with policymakers to help improve society based on this understanding. So there's stuff that happens at the center that looks a lot like what happens at a think tank. There's stuff that happens that looks a lot like what happens at a university center. We think it's one of the only places that's really doing both of these things together. And so by working at both of these layers, I think we're able to do stuff that is hard to do other places. So we can ensure that the results of the research get put into the policymaking process very quickly. Also, we can make sure that the problems that policymakers are facing get put into the research community very quickly. And so we've done a lot of different things to ensure that kind of back and forth and that flow. And I think that that work is incredibly important. And if there are any members of Congress listening, they should definitely check out our website, citp.princeton.edu. And we would be happy to try to help them because we realize that these are really, really hard problems. There's a lot of it is empirically unknown, right? Like what is happening online right now? We actually don't know. Like separate from what effects is this having on people, we don't even know very, very basic questions about the online ecosystem. So there's basic empirical questions that need to be done. There's basic policy evaluation that needs to be done. If we change the laws, if we change the regulations, what will the effects of that be? And then there's also core moral questions that need to be addressed. What kind of society do we want to live in? And I think all three of those issues interact, and those are the kinds of issues that we try to address at the center, and those are the kinds of issues that will be addressed in my next book about prediction.
I think that's an excellent place to wrap up this conversation, Matt. Thank you so much for being generous with your time today and talking about Bit by Bit and where you're going from here.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks to my guests for this episode, Paul Decker and Matt Salganik. A full transcript of the episode is available on the blog post associated with this episode at mathematica.org. Related resources, including a free online version of Matt's book, are available in the episode show notes. This episode was produced by my colleague, the inimitable Rick Stoddard. As always, thank you for listening to On the Evidence, the Mathematica podcast. Stay up to date on future episodes by subscribing on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Good Pods, or wherever you listen to podcasts.